Hello, everyone, and welcome to Heard on the Street, Street Fights podcast, where we uncover the stories behind the companies and, more importantly, the people that constitute this sector of media and advertising that we all call local. So where are they from? What makes them tick? What business and life lessons can we draw from that? So I'm Mike Boland, lead analyst at Street Fight, and our guest today is Harry Dewhurst, president of Blitz, which is an innovator in location intelligence for local marketing. And before that, Harry's had an eclectic and varied career in different parts of the digital marketing stack. So we talked to Harry from our studio in San Francisco about that journey, what he's learned from it, and what we can all take away from that. So here's our discussion with Harry Dewhurst. So Harry, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yep. So we have a lot to talk about, including diving deeper into everything I just mentioned. But first, let's start with the present. So tell us a bit about yourself and Blitz for those unfamiliar.
Sure. So Harry Dewhurst, I'm from the UK, as you may have guessed, but I've lived in the US a couple of times. I've lived in Asia for 5+ years. So I've had quite a lot of exposure to international business, and it's all been very much focused in the technology and advertising sector over the past 12 or so years.
Nice. So let's, and I want to circle back to that, a lot of that, and kind of what you're working on now. But as we like to do on this show, let's kind of start at the beginning. So, you know, tell us about the path that brought you into the world of digital media and advertising, and kind of characterize that time in your life for us.
Unsurprisingly, or it certainly came about somewhat by accident. I actually studied music, and my heart was set on grandeur of being a music producer or some kind of sound technician. Very quickly realized that that would not be a career that I could either, one, easily get into, or two, make very much money doing. So I worked at a company that sold marketing databases to businesses. That then led me down to London, where I joined my first kind of technology startup. I was 19 at the time, joined the business when it was 20 people. And when I left 2.5 years later, we were almost 200. So kind of that was my first taste of real explosive growth in technology companies. And I think it was there that really got my passion excited about being in this roller coaster of innovation.
Sure.
So shortly after that, I decided it was time to start my own business, which was Ring Ring. I started that with my colleague, actually, who was also at the same business, Ben Tatton Brown, and we decided that we could have a crack at it on our own. At the same time as us creating this business, the iPhone was born.
Right.
So that then meant a huge catalyst of change, and we were definitely very, very early in that tsunami of change. As a result, our business grew very quickly. We raised a small amount of money. We grew the team. We became profitable after just 18 months. And then within 2 years of us founding the business, we were merging with another company, Amobee, who had a lot of technology. We had a lot of the advertising smarts, and they had a lot of carrier technology. So it was a meeting of minds, and we combined the businesses into one. At that point, I moved to San Francisco, which is where the business was headquartered, and took on the role of really developing our US operations, because whilst we had an office there, it wasn't really the center of business for us. It was more from a corporate and technology HQ. And then almost like clockwork, wind forward 2 years post our merger, we then sold the business to Singtel in Singapore, mm-hmm. which then in turn meant that I moved to Singapore and then developed out Amobee's Asia business. Back then, marketing and distribution of advertising on mobile was still to Java-based yep, Nokias web. And the likes. So it was in and around that time. Mm-hmm.
And that timeline's always interesting, because we often forget that the iPhone came out in 2007. for that first year, until the App Store came out in 2008, 1 year later, that first year, we basically had those default 16 apps, you know, messages, maps, I forget what the original, like the camera, you know, so it's interesting looking back with, you know, of course, the preponderance of apps and innovation that's come since then. So very interesting. So another pattern that kind of sticks out from that story, that timeline, is a few different acquisitions. So you mentioned Ring, and then Amobee. I keep pronouncing it wrong. And then you.
I don't quite know what the best way to pronounce it is. I never quite settled on it myself either.
Right. And then of course Singtel. So at least I think that's two exits I count. I'm not sure if there were more. But what are, you know, your learnings from being on like the sell side of those acquisitions? And you know, that's we could have a whole podcast just talking about that. But that's often something that there are a lot of startups going through that and always looking for advice, not just the exit itself and the sales process, but, you know, post acquisition, the optimal kind of combination of resources, whether it be culturally or otherwise.
I think, you know, I'm lucky to have gone through two successful acquisitions, both successful in the sense that they concluded,
right.
And also successful in the sense that, you know, post the acquisition, it was harmonious.
Yep.
You know, there's of course many acquisitions that take place that they get past the finishing line, but then it's a total disaster the moment they then have to work together.
Yeah.
So I was fortunate not to experience that. I do think it is a large risk, though. You know, businesses that then become almost desperate to sell, or, you know, they really want to get their liquidity event, maybe can overlook the fact that they're going to then have to work with these people or these companies or, you know, different markets, different regions and so on. And if they're not sure that they can make that work, it could end up coming back to bite them.
Yep.
You know, whether that's in financially from earnouts and so on and so forth, or just psychologically,
yep.
from having to kind of endure it day to day.
Yeah, it seems to me, and this is purely anecdotal, I don't have the data in front of me, but it seems like most acquisitions that I read about and hear about as an industry analyst tend to be unsuccessful when it comes to at least cultural fit, and sometimes on financial measures. So it's refreshing to hear when it does go right and looking at kind of those best practices. So we're actually going to pause for a commercial break. When we come back, more from Harry Dewhurst.
Hi, everyone. It's Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'm here today to tell you about Artillery, which is a new publication and intelligence firm that's focused on VR and AR. Mobile AR, for example, has a large installed base of smartphones and real business models that are materializing around things like influencing local commerce. So we recommend that you go check out the site and its thought leadership of these key topics. And while you're there, you can sign up for the free Artillery Weekly newsletter. So head on over to artillery.co, that's Artillery without an E, and learn about some of the visually immersive technologies that could transform local commerce.
So we're back. My guest is Harry Dewhurst. So Harry, before the break, we were talking about some of the kind of backstory that kind of brought you to the current role at Bliss. So tell us more about that, and not just your current role, but, you know, prior to the kind of role you're in now, you were kind of associated with the company to kind of another capacity.
Sure. So Bliss is founded by one of my closest friends, Greg Isbister. He founded the company 12 or so years ago. So it's been around a long time, and it's always been focused on location,
yep.
Which I think is quite a unique business that it hasn't pivoted away from its original dream. Now, I came to kind of get involved in the business as an investor. I started a small investment fund called Ballpark Ventures, which is still going today, and my first investment was into Bliss. So at that point, about 8 years ago from now, I joined the board of Bliss and acted as an investor. 4 years on, I was chatting with Greg, and I was kind of figuring out what to do next after having my clothing company and my theatre business and my brewery and my beer festival and so on and so forth. Sure. I decided I ought to get, you know, back into technology. So I was toying with starting another business from scratch. But then we landed on let's hitch our wagons together and try and do something significant together. And that's exactly what we've been doing from there on in. So I've been president since then and had an operational role. Mm-hmm.
And that's interesting, too, because, you know, we sometimes see that where investors will, you know, partners will kind of move on to have an operational role within a portfolio company because they just see such a great fit there. Or even the opposite, where a portfolio company will sometimes, you know, join that firm as a partner. That the latter probably is less often, but it's always interesting to see that. Now, in your current role, since you kind of joined in that role, it seems like there have been a lot of notable growth milestones. What are the ones that you would kind of point to?
Yeah, I mean, wind forward 4 years from when I joined. When I joined, we were around 20-something people, really only focused in London. And now we've very much grown internationally. So we have 6 major hubs around the world, but operations in almost 20 countries. Asia was a big part of our growth where I was based. So that was a big part of our kind of growth story. And we've got offices now in Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Thailand, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong. And Greg was also out in Singapore with me during that growth phase. So we were both kind of at the front line doing that, as well as managing the business from a global basis. I think technologically, we've gone from having technology but didn't really see the light of day. Now all of our products are a suite of tools are within a centralized platform that any of our customers can use hands on keyboards, as opposed to through account managers and so on. So that's, sure, I think, quite a significant evolution in terms of our product stack. More recently, expansion into the USA. So 2.5 years ago, we launched our business in New York, which is quite an opposite path to many businesses. You know, typically you would go US first and expand from there on out. We've kind of done it in reverse. But we're really pleased with the traction we're getting in the US, and it's been very exciting.
Very interesting. So in terms of differentiation, you mentioned some of the things technologically speaking. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of the offering, because, you know, location data, location intelligence is a space that has several providers that are all doing kind of unique kind of processes and protocols for collecting data in terms of their unique take on using location as a relevance driver for marketing and then other things which we can get into. But specifically, what are the types of things that you guys are relying on in terms of reliable data sources through which to do that location targeting? Is it location history?
So a couple of the pieces of kind of core data technology that make, I guess, what we do it very valuable is SmartPin, which is a data validation and scoring system. So we, through a whole host of machine learning, can score and ascertain a score for accuracy on various of our data sources. Once we've then done that, of course, it means we can use that as a way to benchmark subsequent data from there on forward. So this is something that's self-learning, self-cleansing, and something that over time gets better and better and better. So that's, I guess, the first very unique part of our data stack. The other part is Smart Scale, which actually stems from almost the business's history. So, of course, being a location business 12 years ago, you know, this was the age of Snake on your phone and so on. So the world was a very different place. Yet there was this company out there that was trying to do advertising messages when you're in a certain place. Now, the technology at that point was Bluetooth originally, so sending screensavers to Nokia devices, or, you know, that was sponsored by Axe or, you know, Dove or whoever it might be. Then the business evolved to delivering a bit more rich content through Wi-Fi. Now, from those days of understanding Wi-Fi and how to reach people in specific locations using that as a proxy, we learned a lot about how IP addresses and so on are allocated around the world. Sure. So we've been able to develop a system that gives us very proprietary data at scale around that centers using public Wi-Fi hotspots.
Sure.
And that's a unique data set that no one else out there is leveraging. So those two pieces combined mean that, you know, we've got very good integrity of the data, because we're sifting and discarding the vast majority, circa 85%. We're also then having a scoring system where it scores the validity of data on a score of 100, and then a self-learning engine that then can benchmark new data sets that come into the platform. Those multiple things working together, I guess, are our secret sauce.
Yeah. Well, that integrity, of course, is a key piece, and the scoring too, because as you know, there's a lot of bad location data out there, whether it be imprecise, whether it be latent, and all of those other factors that cause the majority of data out there to not be precise. And of course, for years it's been sold kind of disingenuously as being a specific location signal, but the actual node may be like miles away or things like that. So I think it's a key part of the value chain there, and that's interesting. Now, are there any particular verticals or types of advertisers that technology maps to in terms of its specialization, or is it kind of broadly defined? Or who are you working with now in terms of clients, or at least what verticals they're in terms of your target market?
Sure. I mean, I think location lends itself to a lot of sectors, but in particular, QSR,
yep.
CPG, auto, luxury/finance. Mm-hmm. I say those ones because, you know, auto and luxury and finance, there's a relatively small number of people, and they're harder to reach.
Sure.
And harder to qualify. And then anything retail, QSR, CPG. February 2016, we raised our Series B fundraising, which was in part led by Unilever Ventures.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, that, I guess, tells you a story around their appetite and interest in location as being something quite strategic to them as a business.
And also very much a vote of confidence for your differentiation as a technology, because they at the size of their company and the amount of location-based advertising they're doing, I'm sure they have a purview to several different options in terms of location intelligence providers. So that's great. Now, what about, you know, beyond marketing? We're seeing a lot of other uses for location intelligence for enterprises, and that can be anything like supply chain efficiency or logistics, or, you know, another interesting use case that's really developed over the last 5 years is hedge fund managers that are using that intelligence to predict, you know, foot traffic and sales for like an upcoming quarterly report in advance and gaining an edge on that kind of equity investing. So what are the types of other kind of, you know, interesting, you know, additional use cases beyond its traditional use in marketing?
Yeah, we're definitely seeing a growth in interest from customers to do stuff that's beyond just targeting of ads.
Yeah.
You know, I think the first step away from it just being a targeting tool is for measurement and attribution, but measurement and attribution not necessarily tied to a specific ad campaign. So retailers are now beginning to work with us, getting raw data sets into their own BI tools and being able to benchmark themselves against their direct competitors.
Sure.
On the street opposite. So so they're gaining a lot of insights on that as to where they're winning market share, where they're losing, is it different times of the day? And we're now developing with a client an ability for them to measure the effectiveness of their outdoor advertising, their billboards, their digital signage, by using the location information of devices we know that were in that that area and being exposed to that digital outdoor or fixed poster sites, and then subsequently took action of going into a retail store and then benchmarking one against the other. So this is quite interesting A/B testing, albeit is tied to advertising, but not digital advertising.
Sure. Well, that's obviously something that's a value add, because it's an area where there was currently this big fog that existed between the ad impression, like looking at a billboard, and the subsequent conversion, however you define conversion, in terms of having that connection between an inherently offline analog, you know, entity
and then, you know, another offline analog action. So yeah. I think that's great. We're going to go to another commercial break. But before we do that, I'm wondering about kind of the what you're working on now or what you're most excited about, what we can all expect for the remainder of 2018 to the extent that you can talk about your roadmap.
Sure. The two big things that we've launched this year and are developing through this year are a product that we're calling Trends, which is, I like to look at it somewhat like Google Analytics meets Google Maps. So analytics of the real world in a map type interface where you can do A/B testing, you can look at different demographies in different parts of a city at different times of the day. And that's a really advanced UI that we're really getting quite excited about. The other part is a partnership that we've done with IBM and their blockchain team that we're using to cast light on the provenance of data. So where did it come from? Yeah. Is the right person being paid for the use of that data and tracking that through? And that gives then confidence to both an advertiser that they're getting data that is from proper provenance, and then also from data providers that they're not contributing data that's being used without them being rewarded for it.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And that could be an entire podcast episode in itself, but it's a very interesting in looking at blockchain, its inherent ability and framework to kind of validate data and sources coming into this discussion of data integrity when it comes to kind of things that advertisers are buying. So very interesting. So we're going to pause there for another commercial break. When we come back, more from Harry Dewhurst.
Hi everyone, it's Mike Bolin, lead analyst at Street Fight, and I'm here today to tell you about Artillery, which is a new publication and intelligence firm that's focused on VR and AR. Mobile AR, for example, has a large installed base of smartphones and real business models that are materializing around things like influencing local commerce. So we recommend that you go check out the site and its thought leadership of these key topics. And while you're there, you can sign up for the free Artillery Weekly newsletter. So head on over to artillery.co, that's Artillery without an E, and learn about some of the visually immersive technologies that could transform local commerce.
So we're back. My guest is Harry Dewhurst. So Harry, before the break, we were talking about what you're doing at Bliss in terms of differentiation, in terms of product strategy, in terms of data and location targeting and intelligence. I'd like to move now into some of the kind of things that you're doing and learnings from that. One of the things I thought was interesting is that you continue to invest. You mentioned you actually came to Bliss initially in the capacity of an investor, but you continue to invest. And the interesting thing is not just in the media and tech and ad tech space. So you're doing lots of different interesting things. Like, for example, one is what I read as a customizable beer company there in Singapore. So you can explain what that is.
Sure. So yeah, that's a business called Trouble Brewing that I was the first investor of, and I sit as a director of the business and started by a very close friend of mine. And, you know, what got me attracted to that was actually from my time when I was running the clothing business, where it was customized men's clothing. And then I think this whole notion of being able to have something tailored specific to you is a trend that's going to continue and will be something that we're going to see more and more of with every mainstream business, whether that's Amazon or Apple. So that's something that, and it's kind of grown a lot quicker than we thought. We've already had to move out of our first brewery. We've built a second brewery just because we couldn't make enough beer. So it's a good problem to have.
Right. Very interesting. And along the same kind of thread of some of the interesting things that you're doing and your kind of lifestyle, a lot of people don't know this, but you have kind of maybe the right adjective is nomadic or transient, or I mean, you can describe it, but you do not have kind of a permanent address and you know, kind of go from place to place. I'm actually very enviable of that type of kind of, it seems very exciting. So you're going from, you know, hotels and Airbnbs, and tell us a bit about that and how you kind of live and work and coexist in that type of kind of setup.
I mean, it almost came out of a byproduct of realizing that by having an address and never being there, it's really quite an awful waste of money.
Right.
So I think, you know, I decided for a period of time I can manage a transient lifestyle and it suits me very well. I have a child in Germany, so I go back and see her every month or so. And then obviously we've got all of our offices around the world, and I've got some interests in Singapore with you know, brewery and so on and so sure. forth. So, you know, there is a new way of life. And I actually think that, you know, with the likes of Airbnb and Uber and so on, it lends itself to an evolution in how people actually will live in the future.
Yeah.
I think the traditional single resident type setup for you know, particularly entrepreneurs and business people may change over time, and maybe I'm part of that change.
Mm-hmm. Well, it resonates with me for a few reasons. One of which is, well before the last 5 years or so in kind of the tech startup world, where it's become, I think, more accepted and even appreciated to work remotely. I've been working remotely since, what is it, 2003. In various kind of writing and analyst roles. Also, it seems that beyond the personal preference or excitement, there's also a business case for that in having presence that is more distributed, in having a greater share of the company that has a greater encompasses a greater part of the overall kind of operating clock, the 24-hour clock in different time zones. So it seems like there's a lot of positives there.
Yeah, I mean, the world's a small place, and it's only going to get smaller with you know, speeds of travel increasing. So
yep.
I think, as I say, this is going to be a trend that's going to only increase.
Mm-hmm. So let's move on to the lightning round. So these are just kind of, you know, fairly quick, short answers that dig a little bit deeper into the kind of interesting person that you are. So what's a profession you'd want to have if you weren't doing what you're doing now?
I touched on it earlier, kind of going back into the forays of music.
I do see a drum set there in the background.
Yes, there is. So I keep it up, but only for pleasure. I think actually maybe in reality, as soon as it becomes a job, maybe the pleasure part of it falls away. I never had an ambition of being a rock star, but I wanted to work in the music industry.
Mm-hmm.
And it still does spring to mind every now and again.
Nice. So what's a company or tech startup that you think it would be most exciting to be kind of part of at early stages, like a fly in the wall with kind of Woz and Jobs, or, you know, the HP garage, or just any company that you admire that you'd want to kind of, you think it'd be exciting to be a part of that early team?
Yeah, I was thinking about this, and I think some of the messaging apps that have just gone through these massive explosive growth,
yeah.
and, you know, companies like Line and WeChat and even WhatsApp to an extent, I just think being there and watching daily figures and usage and growth just balloon. And then, you know, with the likes of WeChat and Line building these new business models around payments and so on, I think there's just such a pace of change that it would just be riveting.
Yeah. And the growth of those companies is interesting, and it's congruent to a theme you mentioned earlier, which is starting outside of the United States and moving in. I think those apps have been very conducive to communications outside of the U.S. because of communication across borders and the SMS system that wasn't as prevalent. Whereas in the U.S., there's such a large block of land that everyone's communicating with each other, and SMS kind of works there. But you do start to see things like, especially with younger generations, things like even Facebook Messenger and the providers that you mentioned, the kind of over-the-top messaging apps. So absolutely, that's an exciting area to watch. So what's your favorite tech product or app that you use as a consumer?
So right now I've just been playing with a lot of like Z-Wave and Zigbee type smart home stuff. So getting all that to work together, being able to use voice assistants to control lights and blinds and door locks and so on.
Yeah.
So I'm getting quite fascinated by that, and, you know, the future is going to be pretty fun.
Oh, absolutely. The Internet of Things, and you may have seen Amazon's hardware event yesterday where, you know, I was surprised with all the things they kept rolling out that there wasn't like a, you know, an Alexa kitchen sink.
Yeah.
You know, really, literally, it was, I think they announced a microwave even at one point. Anyway, so who's someone from the business world that you admire most? So that could be alive or dead.
So I'm going to say Bill Gates for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, you know, his contribution to IT and technology and computing, but then furthermore, his contributions now and even more so to humanity and philanthropy. So I think, you know, the fact that he's balanced those two things just makes him someone to be admired.
Yeah, good answer. What superpower hero would you most want to have?
So what does the superpower I need to have is time travel. that's the thing I'm lacking the most of.
Yeah. So what are some passions or hobbies that help you mentally unplug from work in addition to drum sets and making your own beer?
So cooking is a big passion of mine. In fact, when I left Singtel, I went and worked for free in a Michelin star restaurant just to get that I was a customer of and became friends with the chef and owner.
Amazing.
And he let me go and get trained by his excellent chef. So I'm a big fan of cooking, and then skiing. I love to ski. I can see you've got skis behind you there.
I do. yeah, and that's more great, like cross training stuff. Excellent. So lastly, what are some of your personal goals for the remainder of 2018? We talked about some of the company goals, but what about you as kind of personally?
Well, personally, I'm going to aim not to break my wrist 2 days into the ski season this year. So that was a bit of a boo-boo last year. Professionally, you know, the US is really doing really great guns for us. We're up 300% year on year. We're looking like we're going to have a real good year again next year. So just keeping the foot on the pedal there whilst we're riding this wave. So that's, you know, definitely front of mind.
Excellent. So that's actually all the time we have. So I want to thank you, Harry, for spending time with us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. And thank you all for listening, and stay tuned for future episodes of Heard on the Street. You can find us on streetfightmag.com. Also subscribe on Apple Podcast, and stay tuned for lots more writings, multimedia, and events from Street Fight. So this has been Heard on the Street. I'm Mike Boland. Thanks for listening.